Welcome back to Rude Dude.
Welcome to the Rude Dude Recovery Podcast with your host and resident wet brains, Cam and Hen, two dudes navigating the waves of wellness. Thanks for being here. This week, the dudes sit down with Brian A., another West Virginia recovery staple. Brian shares his story of drug dealing, prison time, and coming to terms with the kind of father he was during his addiction. Hen shares a heartfelt story of his current parenting situation, and Cam chips in as a fellow dad. Please enjoy episode 68 of the Rude Dude Pod. Proud of, man, if I see you look my way, I'm ringing down, down, down. And if I were you, where are you? I'd lay low, cause I want. Welcome back to the Rude Dude Podcast, the show that takes some weight off your plate, puts some pep in your step, and reminds you that haters gonna hate, but you are loved. We are your favorite recovering alcoholics, Cameron the Cree Davis and Henny Lokes the Lobster. I'm all out of sorts. I'm trying to match that intro I did last week, which I'll be chasing that white dragon forever, because that was elite, and that's all I can think about right now. How are you there, Cam?
Well, dude, that's super true, man. You're not going to ever be able to live up to that, and that's okay, dude. I mean, sometimes we have that one shot, you know what I mean? Like, you know, sometimes we just show up and we just got it. You know, that'll spaghetti. Be, yep, that'll live in infamy. As for me, dude, you know, I'm still reporting live from the surface of the sun. It is 113 degrees here currently in Sacramento, California. I have every fan AC unit on. My smud bill is about fucking $3,000. So I'm doing about as good as I can do, man. How are you doing out there in West Virginia?
Hey, I know a guy that does solar and could get you a killer deal. So I don't know why we haven't done that yet.
You know what, dude? That is something to think about. I mean, I'm trying to move. It would increase value. That's a conversation we'll have to think about. You know,
be plus selling smud it. Sucks, actually. But anyway, I'm doing well. I'm kind of, I didn't get to the gym. I went and looked at a property during my normal gym time, which was a complete fucking mess and way too much work. So we're not going to be doing that. But I'm doing well. But before, we have a very special guest today, but before we jump into that, there was one thing I thought about last week's episode that I would be remiss not to mention. First of all, I listened to your episode, congratulating us, the solo episode, and it was very nice, and I want to say thanks for that. But I wanted to say that, you know, I went and had this incredible wedding in Greece, and I forgot to mention that absolutely none of that would have been possible. Not a wedding, period, not a wedding in Greece, not the amazing woman that I landed, had I not gotten into recovery about 7 years ago. I would not be where I am, and none of that would be possible, and I would not have pulled this incredible woman that I pulled had I not made the decision to change my life 7 years ago. And I never mentioned that. And it's very important, because I would just simply not be anywhere near any of these things that I just experienced that were incredible had I not made that decision. So I thought that was important to throw in there.
You know what, dude? That's a good little amendment. And it's actually a very good point, dude, because, you know, where would you be, actually? You know what I mean? Like, sometimes I like to sit back and think about that. I'd be like, okay, so hey, if I didn't get sober, you know, like I said, we got sober around the same time, you know, roughly almost 7 years ago. What would that even look like?
Homeless.
Homeless, yeah, or dead, bro. Homeless or dead, bro. Yeah. And it'd just be scary hours. Yep, scary hours. And here we are getting married in Greece, and you know, all these outstanding things. But that's a conversation for another time. But I'm glad you got to mention it, dude, because it's the fucking truth, bro. It's the truth. You know what I mean?
Well, I know we got a guest to get into, but I just was like, man, how did we have that whole episode without me saying that? So it's important,
dude.
To say.
You're an ungrateful fucking asshole, dude. It's just that's ego. Right. Ego nation.
All right. Well, we have a very special guest. This is a guy who I actually met through Healing Appalachia, which I think we'll talk about a little bit later. I saw him again at convention this year,
and I'm friends with him on Facebook. I see him spreading love and positivity and the kind of shit that we're on. And so I just reached out and asked him to come on. And we'll get a little in more into his story, obviously, now. So we'd like to welcome my buddy, Brian. What's up, Brian?
Not much. Thanks for having me.
How's it going, man? How are you doing today?
Pretty good.
Thanks for being here, brother. So tell us a little bit about how you got into recovery, or a little bit about your story.
I used for a long time. I'm 44. I used for 28 years. And I had no intention of ever really getting clean. It was one of those things that I figured I would die that way. And I woke up one day and I'd committed some crimes I didn't remember committing. Like, I've got a long list of criminal record. I've been in prison twice. I've been arrested like 16 times or some craziness. But the last ones I committed, when the cop asked me about it, I had no idea what he was talking about. But he had a video of me and I had all the stolen property. So I'm pretty sure I did it.
Xanax involved?
Yes, it was.
What was your drug of choice, man?
I hate that question because I never found one I didn't like. I like all the drugs.
Yeah.
But I'd say
heroin. We always have a special one.
Heroin's what ruined my life. Like, that's the one that took over. That's the one that it was made me its bitch, you know?
Opiates, started on pills, went to heroin, something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Good old Lord had the Oxycontin and the heroin and the fentanyl and...
Fucking a tale as old as time, man. You know what? I haven't asked this because we've had a few opiate users on here. I've never actually seen what the appeal was to that drug. Like, I had like popped like some Norcos and shit like that, right? But when I saw all of my buddies who got into like oxys and shit, I'd show up at a party and they'd just be knotted out, right? And I'd sit here and I'd be like, dude, I'm trying to like, you know, I'm trying to get laid and have fun with my friends. Like, what the fuck is going on with that? Like, that doesn't look like a good time. So I guess the long way that I'm kind of trying to ask is, like, what was the appeal to that? Like, was it just to just completely fucking check out? Because I didn't like it, dude, at all. I mean, I'm an alcoholic, which is kind of similar, right? I mean, I just kind of drank and fucking pretty much did the same thing. It just took me longer to get there. What was the appeal of that drug, dude? Because it took out a lot of my friends and
stuff. Just let him answer the question, my man.
That's true, actually. Sorry. I've had a rough day today, dude. It's fucking hot out here, dude. It's like hotter than Dubai, dude. I'm sweating in my room.
I always said that. Like, looking at people using it, you were like, why would you want to do that? You know, you're knotted out. You're drooling on yourself. You're not making any sense. But then you do it, and it's like, hey, that felt pretty good. And then you do it again, and you never catch that first one. You know, it's like you were talking about your intro a minute ago. I'm going to be chasing that thing forever. That first high was awesome.
Yeah.
I still remember the first Oxycontin, because Lord Habs and Percocets and all that, you know, was one thing. But I still remember the first Oxycontin I did. The girl came over to my house and gave me a real little bitty line of it. And I thought she was just being a stingy bitch. And I did a line of it and I puked immediately. And I loved it. It was like, this is the greatest thing ever.
You know, it's funny because I've had this debate with people. I've been like in rehab. I'm like, why would you want to be nodding out? And they're like, why would you want to be like falling over, throwing up on yourself? And I'm like, well, I guess that's the point. Everybody kind of has their own thing, different stuff they're into. Tried it. I've tried several iterations of downer or other like opiates and stuff. And I thought they were cool, but it wasn't like my favorite. But I just think everybody kind of has their own thing that they're into. And
I always make fun of the fact, especially in the rooms, you hear people talk about, well, I did this, but or new people especially, but you know, but I didn't do that. Or I did this drug and I didn't do it that way. Like, I wrecked the whole thing. I did all the drugs all the ways.
All the ways.
Yeah, I mean, if you had it and it was free to me, then I was into it.
Yeah, show me how to do that again. I'll do that.
So what was the moment? What was the thing? Or you said you were talking about where the cop showed you a video of a crime you don't remember committing. Was that the moment that made the big change?
I think so. I think that's one of those things that's hard to pinpoint. But I don't know if y'all can hear that, but I got a neighbor with no exhaust apparently. But
oh, we heard.
I was 40. Sometimes I think I just aged out. And I was facing a big boy sentence. Like I said, I've done a couple prison sentences, but they were one to somethings. And for it's a messed up mentality when a one to something's okay. Like, could you imagine getting up here like now?
Like, no biggie. Yeah.
But at that point in time, a one to something didn't bother me. But this time they were threatening me with like a decade. And it was like, ooh, I don't, that scares me. And I don't want to do that.
Yeah.
Was it suspended and you were allowed to go to rehab if you suspend your sentence, something like that?
That's a good story. I love this one. And I'm sorry if anybody's lost somebody, but COVID saved my life. I got arrested February 7th, 2020. That's my clean date. You know, COVID hits a month later. It was already starting, but it was on the boats at that point. You know, remember they had everybody like on boats and wouldn't let them come on the shore?
Yeah.
And but March 15th is when the world shut down, or 18th, something like that. Anyway, doesn't matter. But the jails kept getting overcrowded. Where I first went to, like, I messed up on my court dates. So when I first went to court, they owed me like three different hearings. And, you know, I'm a jailhouse lawyer. I'm like, oh, they're going to let me go. And not only, like, they dropped my I got charged with arson and felony, or felony, they were prohibited person with a firearm, which was my violent crimes. Ooh. And they dropped them. They didn't have, like, apparently I'm a shitty arsonist because I didn't burn nothing down. And the guns were like collector's item guns. They weren't nothing like threatening. So they dropped those charges, and I'm like, I'm going home. And they wouldn't even let me go to rehab. I asked for rehab, and they told me no, that with my record, I have 13 felony intent charges, that that's considered violent, and that they're going to charge me with a recidivist act. And that's what's going to give me a decade. And then the overcrowding COVID caused, they kept letting people go. Like, they let all the misdemeanors go. Then they let anybody that had less than a year left go. Then they let anybody who was facing less than X amount of time go. And it just got to where my number was called.
And then it got to people with red beards. They're like, yeah, you got a red beard. Go home.
They told a bunch of us, you can go to rehab, but it's not part of your sentence. You still got to go. This is pre-sentence. You still got to go in front of a judge and face sentencing. And most of everybody was like, no, I ain't going to do that. There's three of us that committed to do it. And I was like, I'll do it. I need some help. But at this point, I was kind of realizing, you know, I'm out of control. I need some help.
Yeah.
And I went to rehab in Somersville. And a 28-day program. And at the end of it, I was going through some stuff with the therapist there. And I called my lawyer and asked if I could stay longer. And they let me. And I think that impressed the judge. Nice. I was going home until sentencing. And I think that impressed the judge. And like the day before I left rehab, they called and they dropped it to three misdemeanors and gave me 18 months of probation.
Dude. Those are those God moments, man. Like that's like, you know, you get that one final chance, right? Like, had you not, I always like to play out those scenarios when I listen to stories like this. Like, had you not been one of those three that took the rehab initiative, right? Because you took the initiative to do it. It's not like it was forced. You know, something was pulling you to do that, and then you do it, and then lo and behold, you're like, hey, I'm gonna take this serious and get sober, and here comes this blessing, like, hey, I'm dropping these fucking felonies. You're looking at 10 years. 10 years scares the shit out of me, dude. Like, that sounds fucking terrible, bro. Like, you know 10 years in prison sounds fucking terrible. So I'm glad that worked out for you. So did it just click right away when you got to rehab, if you asked for the extended?
I always say, like, it's a process. I'm sure y'all guys know. There's different levels. I like the onion analogy. You know, there's different layers to it. Shrek's a great movie, The Onion Theory. But I said when I first got there, like, I was escorted in by two COs. It's really funny if you know me, because I'm soft. Like, I'm a big guy, but I'm soft.
Teddy bear.
I showed up to rehab. I just shaved my head with a jailhouse razor, so there's like gashes out of my skull. I'm in oranges, shackled together, and the two biggest COs in the place escort me into this rehab. So it looks like, you know, Con Air shit. You know, like, I'm...
Yeah, that's exactly what I was thinking about. Got, like, the Hannibal Lecter mask on and shit.
It's just, like, horrible. But I get there, and the COs are being an ass to me, and I don't even realize it, because I've done enough time. I'm just used to COs acting like that. But the nurse that was doing my strip search was told them to stop. He's like, y'all got to stop. You don't have to treat him like that. And it was that first act of love, that first act of kindness that was like, hey, I matter, you know?
Yeah.
I still love that. Isn't that funny? That's like, I can feel that in my heart, because it's interesting how you put it too, where you didn't think much of it, because that's how they are in jail. And you probably hadn't had anybody really like stick up for you or show you love or treat you like you were human for a long time. And it just takes that one little thing to be like, oh wow, I'm somebody cares about me. Maybe I'm worth something. Maybe somebody, maybe I could do something with this, you know, and you get that feeling of love. Like they say, you know, other people love us until we learn to love ourselves. Was that a thing for you, like where you felt like you didn't know how to love yourself at first?
I'll give some history. Most addiction comes from childhood trauma. I think most people agree with that. And it's like 86% of addicts have some childhood trauma in their history. I really don't. I came from a good family. Like, we were in church, my parents were together. I'm a baby of 7. I was a spoiled little shit. But mine came from an identity problem. Like, again, growing up in that large of a family, you don't have an identity. And when I first started doing drugs, all of a sudden I became cool. And then I started selling drugs, and I was the man. And it just took me about 40 years to learn the difference in the man and a man. And let's be honest, I'm probably still learning that.
Yeah, that's interesting. I think it's important to make that distinction too, because I'm pretty similar. Like, I grew up in a good family. I really didn't have a lot of like trauma or anything. And I think identity crisis is a good one. Mine wasn't the same as yours, like the large family, but I think it was more like lacking self-confidence and feeling more confident when I was drinking and using, and just not, and like people pleasing, anxiety, all that kind of stuff, where I just felt more comfortable when I was using, and, you know, came out of my shell a little bit. And so, yeah. And I think it's important because for me, I think it kept me out of the rooms for a while, or made me not relate to people, because people were like, yeah, I was, you know, molested when I was 7, or my parents beat me nonstop, and all these stories. And I was like, well, that's not me. I'm not like that. Like, I don't even belong here. Like, and it can get you messed up in your head when, you know, like if you're looking for the differences. But yeah, I'd like to hear, you know, stories like that, because I think there are a lot of people like that. And it's important to, you know, make the point that we all belong no matter how we got there. And we're all welcome. You know, we're all welcome to get some recovery and some love in our life.
Amen, for sure.
Yeah, man, I think it's funny too, because yeah, it's three guys sitting here, right? And I can't think of any childhood trauma either, right? Like, there may be like some, like I was like an anxious kid. If you've listened to a lot of my episodes, still am. I'm still an anxious fucking ball. But you know, yeah, there was no like crazy catalyst, right? It was just, hey, this is me, right? But my mom, this is where I'm going to tie this in. My mom comes from a family of 15, and I saw it. Your story of trying to find an identity in that mix of that hodgepodge of a bunch of kids. Actually, that theory kind of adds up, man, because a good handful of those kids turned into addicts and alcoholics. Some of them went to prison. Some of them are dead, died in the disease. You know what I mean? So maybe it's like, hey, I just got to stand out, because you can get kind of lost in the sauce with a family that big. I couldn't imagine having 7 kids, man, or even 15. Like, I can't even handle my 2. But I mean, holy shit, dude. Like, dude, that's another conversation for another time. So we did 28 days. We got an extension. Did you get out? Did you sober living, that whole deal?
No, I came actually right back to the house I was arrested in, which is, you know, one of the no-nos, and you say you shouldn't do that. But again, I had a good support system. My father's been dead for a long time, but it's my mother's house. And my 2 kids were here, 2 of my 3, I have 3 kids, but 2 of them were here. And at the beginning, I wouldn't go anywhere. It was kind of funny. Like, before I had a job, I binge watched every Avenger movie there was, because Disney Plus was the only streaming service she had. So I just said, I binge watched every Avenger movie. But I sold drugs in this town for a long time. I knew if I went to GoMart or Walmart, I was going to see somebody. So I didn't do anything. Mm-hmm. And then I got an ENA. And started going to meetings. And then I got a job in recovery and started meeting people that way. And I'll give a shout out if you're in Southern West Virginia. I know y'all aren't, but the Warner Picnic in Bluefield is this giant, you can't call it a picnic anymore. It's huge. There's live music. It goes on for 12 hours, huge fireworks show, biggest gratitude circle I've ever been in. And it was the first thing I did for fun, sober. And I tell her, Lori Warner runs it. And I always tell her, like, this was the first thing I did that was truly fun when I wasn't getting high.
that big aha moment where you're like, oh wow, you can have fun sober because you never thought it was possible before.
I wasn't scared. I wasn't looking over my shoulder. I wasn't afraid. Now it was really funny because Recovery Point Bluefield is right there. And so all those guys are there. And when I go down there, I'd sold half of them drugs. They were all in rehab now.
What did your program look like kind of in the beginning? And what does it look like now? Like, what do you do for your recovery?
Good question.
At the beginning, I was really all everything. I think it was getting the job in recovery and getting taught, like, addict is not necessarily a positive word. And the word clean is really a bad word. And I was doing all this really harm reduction kind of stuff. But I'm still going to NA meetings. I'm still going to AA meetings. I spent most of my first year in AA. But I was hitting the NA when I got back to Beckley. And I was mixing it all together. And I mean, it worked, but it probably wasn't the best. It's really funny now because there's people in NA down here that were trying to guide me. And I would argue and fight with them. Like, I wouldn't identify as an addict in the meeting. I was identifying as a person in recovery, and so many people would they weren't yelling at me, but they'd, you know, take me after a meeting and go for a little talk and walk. And there's a young lady, Brittany O, I think, you know, Cassie talked about her. I listened to y'all show about her too. Mm-hmm. Brittany O is a giant down here, but she puts me in a car and drives me to Huntington and just tells me about myself for 2 hours. And I love her for it because
she's really cool. I know her too.
Yeah, but it actually came down to an old guy in an AA meeting told me, Brian, if I asked you to take off your shoes in my house, would you do it? I'm like, of course. He's like, well, I'm asking you to identify, and again, that was AA, so he's asking you to identify as an alcoholic in my meeting. And it kind of was like, okay. And then the more I get into it, the more I realize it's just about becoming one. And I always say, I'll share this about once a year, that I would love for us all to identify as like beautiful badasses. I can just imagine going to a meeting and everybody's like, I'm a beautiful badass. My name's Brian. But I get the fact that new guy walking in the room doesn't feel like a beautiful badass. Mm-hmm. So we got to identify as an addict. Well, everybody can identify that way.
You know, to me, this might sound backwards to some people, or maybe especially non-addicts. But I remember the first time I identified, and I think I was in AA, as an alcoholic. And I think I started crying, and I felt this kind of weight lifted off me because I knew it was true. And I don't know if this was your story or not. I knew I was. I don't think I wanted to say it. I don't want to admit it. And to me, I felt like there was power in just saying it and owning it. Because, you know, it's like step one, we identified that we had a problem, which I'm butchering it because my brain doesn't work. But the first step is just fucking identifying the problem. I am an addict. And there was power in just fucking admitting it, because you can't fix it if you don't think you are. Until you like own that, then you can move forward. So I found power, and I was wondering if like you didn't want to say it because you weren't ready to completely commit and own that you were an addict. Was that part of it at all?
When you're an opiate addict, it's a little different. Like, you know, you have a problem. You know, I've been Narcan like 6 times. I knew I had a problem. It was like, I think it was just, I'm too smart for my own good sometimes. So all these things are being taught in these harm reduction classes and stuff like that. And it makes a lot of sense. And I still completely agree with it, to be honest. But I also agree that there's a difference in what I say in my house, what I say in a meeting, and what I say on a public format.
Yeah. Can we argue about the clean thing for a minute? Can you remind me, because this kind of annoys me, what is the obsession with the clean is a bad word thing again?
Clean insinuates that when you're using that you're dirty, and that makes it a good and bad thing. It makes it a moral failing rather than a disease.
Okay.
See, I guess my problem is that I like that explanation and I agree with that. I guess my problem is the way that people go about it and approach it. Like, if a newcomer says, I'm clean, and somebody shouts, you're sober, you're not clean. Like, that's not how the fuck you do it. That's not showing love and empathy and helping someone. My thing is like, are we going to argue over semantics, or are we going to love this person who's trying to get help for themselves? That's I get your explanation, and that sounds great, but it's always, to me too, it's approach. If you want to help someone, you talk to them after a meeting and you pull them to the side. If you want to look smart and think you're fucking cool, then you're going to do it in front of people and make them feel stupid, which is what we don't. The very last thing that we want to do in a meeting. So that's the only issue that I have with like pointing that out. If you pulled me aside after a meeting and explained that, I'd be like, cool, I get that. I won't say it anymore, but it's just how people do it sometimes that bothers me.
Dude, I gotta say something. We're actually highlighting a very important thing, kind of, you know, organically here. The random issues that come along with the rooms, right? Like you just described, Henry, like if somebody was to come in, a newcomer to come in and say, hey, I had 5 days clean, and somebody, you know, who's on fire about not saying that comes at them in the wrong way, that's going to turn them off to the fucking rooms right away. Right. Mm-hmm. Like, okay, hey, I was going to come here because I'm, you know, I'm struggling, and this is supposed to be a safe place, but now I'm getting fucking berated. And if I'm going to get berated, I might as well just go and use and get berated by everybody, because it's constantly happening anyways. And then when you get into the semantics of, hey, identifying as an addict or identifying as an alcoholic, that's another issue too, dude. Like, you see that sometimes. I mentioned it on one of our other podcasts or one of our other episodes, the gatekeeping one. I had a guy at an AA meeting, a guy identified as an addict, and he got absolutely his ass chewed by the guy chairing that meeting because it was an AA meeting. What are we doing? What are we doing? And collectively as a group, like you said, like a group of love badasses, whatever you said, right? like, dude, we should be coming together and not worrying about fucking specific verbiage, right? And I'm not trying to get into this crazy debate on how it's supposed to go, because it's been around a lot longer than all three of us have been alive. But there are certain things that, dude, if I came into the rooms and somebody said something like that to me, I'm walking the fuck out. And you know what that means to me? That means that I'm probably dead, or I'm probably in prison, or I'm probably, you know, who knows what that looks like, right? Like, don't be coming at me in the beginning stages of my recovery trying to get me on my vernacular, you know, especially when I don't know. I'm just trying to fit in. You know, does that make sense? Because that just now I'm fucking pissed off. Now I'm getting mad over here.
It does. I never think a chair should interrupt a meeting like that unless it's something horrible. You know, like if somebody is hurting, harming the room, then the chair can interrupt. After that, my first thing is I'm going to lead by example. I'm going to keep doing it the way I was taught and I think is right, and I'm going to hope you adapt to that after you come to some meetings. And if you're not, then after the meeting, hey, let's go get a cup of coffee and have a talk about this verbiage or that verbiage or whatever.
Yeah, it's just like, you know, we say the newcomer is the most important person, but people want to make them feel stupid in front of a room full of 30 people. Like, that's just what I can't stand for. But I get that. All right. So you wanted to talk about fatherhood. And I think when we were talking, you said like you lost custody of your kids and then you got them back. So let's dig into that a little bit.
Let me tell the story. Okay, you know, using young, start selling drugs, go to college, go to Marshall. I meet a girl, and it was like the perfect little storybook thing. Met her at a football game, walked her back to her dorm room, fell in love, had a kid, got married. Okay, did that one backwards. But, you know. But then my addiction takes over, and especially, like, I think I'm Tony Soprano, and I start sleeping with everybody and mess up my marriage. Then I have a kid with another young lady, and I'm a single dad with two daughters.
The Gumar.
Yeah. But I have both daughters at my house, and I'm thinking, look how sensitive I am. I'm inviting other women over. I'm like, look how sensitive I am. You know, I'm a male raising two daughters. I have my daughters 3 days a week. I am so awesome. But I'm selling dope out of the house. So it's not long until somebody comes in to rob me. And they bring guns in there, and they put my six-year-old daughter on the ground. And I lose custody of that child, like, you know, rightfully so. Not saying anything bad about her mom. Her mom took my custody the next day, and that's what I deserved. Mm-hmm. But I fought that one just barely. Like I always say, I always try to point that out. I was like, I didn't really fight hard. Like, I quit doing drugs, but I didn't sell them. I didn't quit selling them. And then when court came around, I got caught selling dope. Like, the next time, I always told the story, the next time people came in my house with guns, they were matching little outfits and took me to jail. But gave me a place to stay for a couple of years. And the family court judge was pissed because I had been arguing that I was a victim. I shouldn't be punished for being a victim. And I have no idea why these guys robbed me. And then I get caught with like 30 stacks. And so like, you knew exactly why you got robbed.
That's a fucking good one, dude.
We love playing the victim, huh?
Yeah, I was good at it. But I do 18 months. I got a 1 to 15. I do 18 months. I come out and I try to get custody of my daughter. And the judge tells me the most reasonable thing ever. She says, clean up your parole. Or, you know, she said the word nicer than that. Finish your parole and come back. But I'm so arrogant, so prideful that I'm like, who's this judge to judge me, you know? And I got high that day. And I never really looked back. I never really tried to
get. Who this lady thinks she is in her robes on her high?
Sitting above me like she's special. But then I have a third kid, and like that mom's getting high with me, so she doesn't care.
Okay.
We do that for the life just gets dark. Like,
and you still didn't have the other, but you didn't have any custody of the other two at that point. No,
I didn't see the oldest one I don't see for like 13 years. The other two are with me because again, their mom's getting high with me. So we're just doing our thing. Life gets real dark. Like those kids saw some trauma they shouldn't see. One of my drug dealers took my middle daughter to her first carnival, and my son was taught to shoot basketball by another plug. You know, it was like just not good parenting.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And I go back to prison. When I come out this time, the woman had left. Like every jail sentence I went, she'd go shack up with somebody, but she'd come back when I came back. And this time she was like, I'm with him. You can have the kids. And I had to cut the kids, and then but I went out again. And my sobriety lasted about 3 days, and I went out again. But then when I came back in 2020, you know, I got that last arrest, I changed. Another thing I did in jail different was, you know, you get a 15-minute phone, or I made a 15-minute phone call every day. The first dozen jail sentences, I always would chase a girl. It was usually that same girl, but I was always calling around trying to find her, find a number. I needed that girl. The last time I was like, Mom, take my kids and just put money on the phone. That's all I need. I called my daughter every day. And if you've ever been to jail, like there's people run the phones, you know, it's like this gang or that gang or it's sometimes it's race, sometimes it's city, whatever it is. But I will say that they were all considered enough. They would tell you that Brian's not talking to some hoe. Brian's talking to his daughter. He gets a phone time. And
nice.
So I called my daughter every day for, it was 9 months in that sentence I did. And we really built a bond. If you pay attention to my Facebook, she's my ride or die. Like she's my best friend. We have way too many inappropriate conversations for a 15-year-old girl, but it's, I'll tell you in about 10 years if I fuck her up or not, but I don't think so. But I came home and we even got closer, and my son's got a little bit of social issues. Again, I think it's, you come home, we don't know if mom and dad's going to be there. Yeah. So he still struggles some with that, but an important thing too, I always say, I got my kids in therapy before anything bad happened. I was at a rehab, I took that ACE test, I think we've all taken. Where you see how much traumatic events you had in your childhood. And I'm looking at my childhood and I'm like, I got like one. I'm looking at their childhood and I'm like, oh shit.
Kids have all 12.
Yeah. I'm like, my kids are hit. So I put them in therapy right off the bat and we got them some help and they turned out pretty good with it. And,
good, man.
The oldest daughter's in Huntington. I'm in Beckley and I get a job offer in Huntington to go make a bunch of money. And I'm like, it's a sign from God. I'm going back. So I go to Huntington and I'm writing her every week. I'm writing her. Hey, I'm coming to Huntington. Hey, I'm in Huntington. Hey, I sent her $100 for her birthday. And I'm just writing her, writing her, writing her. And she sends me a letter back that basically told me to fuck off. That she's 19 at the time and she didn't want nothing to do with me. She sent me the $100 back. Like how pissed off is a 19-year-old to send you $100 back? You know? No. But I always say that's one of the places NA really saved my life. Because I was told to get four friends, get a sponsor and three solids because somebody will answer the phone. And if you're really going through some shit, somebody will tell you what you want to hear. Mm-hmm. And it really did that day. Like I had a great little circle that I made out of NA and they really helped me through that.
Yeah.
But,
quick question, man. And it's just kind of, cause some of that's kind of heavy, right? You know, when you think about like being a parent and when we involve children in it, like I'm blessed that I didn't have any kids until I got sober. Right. So luckily my kids I haven't seen anything. But my question to you is, does, you know, having somebody come in and hold your kids at gunpoint, like, how do you process that now? Like, did that eat you up for a while? Or did you just not care? You know what I'm saying? Like, so when you were using, like, you're like, oh, hey, this is just my life. Like, you know, we don't give a shit when we're fucked up. But after you got clean, did that really kind of hit? Like, holy shit. Like, this is fucked up.
Yeah. It, to this day, it bothers me. If you notice, I get a little teary talking about it. I was just worried about getting my revenge. Like, you came in my house, I'm going to get mine back. But once I got sober, I realized, like, that was a stupid attitude. That was, again, pride getting in the way. I was, instead of being there for my child, I was worried about, you know, how I looked to other people. And was more worried about getting revenge than I was taking care of my kid.
Yeah. Well, I can relate to you, man, just so you don't feel like the only bad parent here. I had my daughter when I was 18. And first of all, an 18-year-old, any 18-year-old, not even in addiction, really isn't prepared to be a father. But I was also deep in the throes of alcoholism and actually doing a lot of cocaine at the time. And my daughter and me, it was me and her mom, and we were, you know, oil and water. It was a wild time, and definitely did a bunch of things that I'm not proud of. And I gotta say this right now. So my stepdaughter now is, she's 6, and I'm really close with her. She's really awesome, and it's just been kind of fucking me up lately because I've been having so much fun with her. She's learning to read. We play basketball. She's my little homie. You know, I got her swinging a hammer on my job site the other day. And it just makes me so sad to think about how I missed that and squandered that with my first daughter. Because we lived together for a while, but by about the time she was roughly my stepdaughter's age, she kind of got taken away from me by my parents. And then I started going to rehabs and jails and all kinds of shit. And I've just been cherishing this time with my stepdaughter, but it's also just made me really, really sad that I missed it. And I don't really remember, like, Lyndon's learning to read. So you're driving around, she goes, what does C-A-R-L-S spell, or, you know, whatever. And I'm like, dude, I don't even remember when my daughter was learning to read. I remember one time I put her to bed when she was about 4 years old or something. And I was like, oh my God. This is the first time I've ever put her to bed sober. She was 4 years old. Cause I was fucked up every single day and night, but, got me going there. But yeah, man, I'm here with you and I get it. And, you know, it's, can't change the past. We can only change our behavior and what we do moving forward. So go on. Sorry, I hijacked your story there.
Oh, no, it's fun. I like somebody that can relate. But after she told me to fuck off, like, one of the people that I was talking about, they told me, let go and let God. You know, we hear that a lot, too. She's like, mm-hmm. She's asked you to give her some space. Give her some space. So I did. Mm-hmm. Ended up the job ended. It was a grant job. And they're like, hey, you got 7 months left, but you can move back to Beckley and keep your salary. I'm like, well, cool, you know, because I kind of fucked up at Huntington anyway. So I packed my shit, moved back to Beckley, and that was December 21. In May of 22, she walked back in my life. It's going to be here again. And she came to my nephew's graduation, and we walked and talked. And I always talk about, like, I'd gotten the gym in February, and I'd gotten real fat, like I was 270 pounds. And I always make the joke, I was like, and thank God, like, that's one of those things that foresight is great, because me and that little girl walked like 2 miles talking, and I would never have been able to do that like 2 months ago. I would have been dying of a heart attack, you know? She'd have killed her dad. But when she first graduated high school, she moved out, or like, her mom was real strict, which is really funny because me and her mom used to party. But her mom, I guess, went the other way when we split and got real super strict. So she moved out of her house and she moved in with this guy. Like, he was gay. It wasn't like a relationship. It was just a friend thing. but he was an addict. And she was like, living with him, I learned to understand you. And it sucks. Like, that's another one of those touching moments. And it sucks as that kid went back out. And I always was like, I really would love to do something to save that kid because of what happened. But yeah. It's just one of those things. But yeah, she understands a lot about addiction. She understands a lot about resentments and just all of it. We've walked and talked forever. And since then, I try to go see her monthly. It's more like every 2 months. I think I've seen her 3 times this year, and it's, you know, July, so I don't do as good of that as I should. But we snap each other every day. She knows we can talk. She's it's a different relationship, and I always tell her, like, I'm not trying to be your dad. Like, your stepdad did a way better job than I did. I was horrible. She, like, her mom got remarried, and this other guy raised her, and that dude's my hero, you know.
That's right. Absolutely. Yeah, man, that's hard. Man, you got me thinking. But yeah, I think one of the important parts there, like you said, is the let go and let God. We talk about a lot where when one of our favorite, do you know Randall Brown?
I don't think so. Oh, yes, I do. Brian, yes, I do.
You know, yeah, probably do. But anyway, one of his things is, I'm sober now. Do you forgive me? Because people going to rehab, their first day into rehab, like, hey, do you trust me again? Can I have the car? Can I move back in? It's like, no, motherfucker. You were fucking me over for 25 years. No, I don't trust you. Like, what are you talking about? But, you know, people don't have to forgive you on your timeline, or just because you changed doesn't mean all of a sudden that you magically get all the trust and all the love and all that back. So there is like a patience thing. And I just had a kind of a breakthrough with my daughter. Her and I were really close when she was younger. And then as she got older and started to understand, she's gained some big resentments against me. And then the last time I was home, I talked with her and I was like, I get it. I understand why you're mad at me and you deserve that. And you don't have to forgive me right now. But just know that I love you and I'll always be here. Whenever you're ready, I'll be here. And I think it made a big difference in our relationship. She's come around since then. But did you have some, Cameron?
Well, I mean, I'm just sitting here. This is a beautiful fucking conversation. I think, you know, the saying, like you said, we like, you know, give it to God and yada yada yada. You know, it does when we do what we're supposed to be doing. It does eventually just all work out, though, doesn't it? Like mm-hmm. it just does. And I've said this ad nauseum on here, but like for newcomers and people in the beginning of recovery, like you just don't believe that shit, right? Like you could be like, hey, I've been sober for a year and they still didn't come back. Or, hey, I was sober for 6 months and they still fucking hate me. And this is never going to change. But then lo and behold, like you said, like what, like the fates would have it and they align. And now, you know, you go on that walk and it changes everything, right? And you're snapping your daughter again, right? And you're having these adult conversations and it's fucking beautiful, right? She's not sending you back $100 anymore. I bet you she'd probably take it if you resend her $100 now this time. And you know, the same thing goes for Henry's situation, right? Like she comes to the age of reasoning and goes, hey man, this was actually kind of fucked up. And then lo and behold, you know, you have the conversation, she matures up and there's some acceptance to what it is, right? And all we can do is just keep doing what we're doing, right? And as long as we keep doing that, then who knows what else is going to come? I mean, what other blessings are going to come, right? Like, who knows? You know what I mean? And that's the beauty of it, man. That's why we do it. That's why we do it. Another thing I wanted to kind of hammer home, Henry, and I just wanted to say that I haven't heard you bring this up, but I really sympathize with you on that Lyndon thing, dude. You almost had me in tears there, pal, because that sounds hard, right? Like I couldn't imagine as a father, right? Like I said, we know my situation. Like if I was like, hey, I was fucked off this whole time, I don't know how I would deal with that. I don't know how I would deal with that. And then hopping into another scenario and redoing it and being the dad that, you know, inside you're like, hey, I should have been this and I wasn't. And so having to come to peace with that has got to be a fucking hard journey. And I respect both of you guys for it, dude. So that's my little spiel on what you guys were talking about, because that's some heavy fucking shit, dude.
Yeah, I appreciate it. It's very bittersweet. It's cool to be the stepdad that this girl deserves, and it fucking hurts like hell to know that I wasn't, you know, previously. But, you know, it's funny because Kristen and I were talking about it, and she was consoling me, and I am the number one proponent of, we can't change that old shit back there. We can only change what we do moving forward. But fuck, it's hard when it's like my daughter's life, you know. It's not just like, you know, all the shit. I went to jail and fucking I crashed cars and whatever, kind of, that's whatever, you know. I forget about all that, doesn't matter. But the fact that, you know, that time that I'll never get back is rough. But to bring it back to the lighter side, which the other part you were talking about is why I thought it was so important to say that my wedding in Greece would not have happened had I never gotten into recovery. These are these blessings we talk about. I couldn't imagine affording a vacation. I couldn't imagine planning a vacation. I couldn't imagine, you know what I mean? None of that. So when the other thing that comes to mind is, don't quit before the miracle happens. This stuff doesn't come back like quickly or as fast as we want it to sometimes, but it fucking comes, man. And you just hang in there and it gets better.
It definitely does. My kids are different, so we kind of take different vacations. But like last year, I got to take my son to the NFL Hall of Fame. Like, you know, he's a sports guy.
Nice.
And it was just huge. Like, he loved it. And then last weekend, 2 weekends ago, whatever it was, me and the middle daughter went to King's Dominion. And that was her thing. She just loves it. And the oldest daughter last year messed up her financial aid, and she needed a couple few hundred bucks, or they were going to have to skip a semester of school. And it was great to have the ability to say, just send it to her. Say, here, yeah, there you go.
Yeah.
And absolutely, none of that happens without sobriety, you know.
Absolutely, man.
So is these, you know, rekindled relationships with your kid, is that a big part of your why you stay sober today?
Definitely. I am. I don't guess we even really got into the job thing, but I am a case manager at an MAT clinic, and I'm in a master's program to become a therapist. And I preach to my people, you got to do it for you. You got to do it for you. You got to do it for you, you know, because you could lose those kids. Something could happen and the kids could just decide they hate me. Tragedy could happen and be taken away from me. And I still got to be sober. So you got to do it for you. But I do think there are things that motivate, and I talk openly, like my kids go to NA meetings that I talk openly about. I tell them, I was like, both your parents are addicts, or the youngest two, both your parents are addicts. Three of your four grandparents are addicts. I don't know the genealogy beyond that, but I'm going to bet it keeps about the same ratio. And you're going to get this shit. The only thing you're going to get to decide is what you're addicted to. I suggest work or Jesus or something, because heroin sucked.
Yeah, you know, yeah. Working in that field, sorry, Hen, working in that field will really keep you honest too. It'll really keep you honest. I have some treatment facility experience, and it's cool to see, you know, the people change during that process. But there's another good thing you brought up, dude, that, you know, there's always a secret why. Like, Ashley won't let me say it, like, but I got sober for my wife, right? She was my girlfriend at the time, but that was the catalyst of my bottom, right? Eventually, I came to the realization that I was doing it for myself. I always feel like there's some, you know, like you said, like maybe it was to get out of the prison sentence. Or Henry, what was your why? There had to be something. What was it? Like, there was some sort of extracurricular, or did you just fucking wake up one day and just be like, I'm done?
Dude, I was tired.
Yeah, I was tired, too.
I'm not going to West for fucking Virginia. I'm not fucking going to West Virginia. And then one day I was like, all right, let's go to West Virginia, dude. This ain't it.
Yeah, yeah.
I didn't, and I wasn't like, I'm done forever at that point, but you know, it got there, you know, and it was my fourth residential treatment. And I was like, man, this shit's it's maybe it's about time. Maybe I partied enough. Maybe I had enough fun and did enough stupid shit. I think I'm good now. But you mentioned working in recovery too, and most of my friends work in recovery, and we were just talking about the other day. You know, one of our friends went out, unfortunately, which he's back at treatment now, so that's good. Two of my friends went up to the ladder today, actually, so that's really exciting. But I was talking about it with another guy, and he's new in recovery, and the guy who had to go back to treatment was living with him, and he was like, "Yeah, this dumbass said this and did that, and he son of a bitch was." And I said, "It's fucking wild being on the other side of this, isn't it, buddy?" Because you hear their stupid fucking games and their stupid ass reasoning and how many people are worrying about him and calling each other and say, "Do you know where he's at? We need to get him to treatment. Did you see him today? Did you check on him? Did he wake up this morning?" And when you see the other side of it, it's easy for us to sit on our little high horse and be like, "This dumb motherfucker." We were that dumb motherfucker. I know I was, like 100 times. And we also see how we thought we weren't affecting anybody, but I'm calling 7 different people. "Well, yeah, he's okay. Yeah, no, we talked to him. No, so-and-so talked to him. Yeah, well, we're trying to get him over to detox," and we're all day long. And it's like, you'd think nobody cares, but there's a bunch of fucking people worried about you when you're using. And it's funny to be on this side of it, but it's also funny to see how stupid we sounded, the excuses we have and the lies we try to tell, that when now we're on this side of it, it's like, "Buddy, we wrote this book, all right? You can't bullshit a bullshitter. Like, I know you don't need to borrow $5 to go get your shoes cleaned at the mall, okay?" Or like whatever stupid shit they try to say. But it reminds you, like, pizza. Yeah, I don't want to do that again.
One of my consumers has one of my old POs. So I talked to her, and we have a really neat relationship today. But I was horrible to that woman. Like, I lied and ran from her all the time. And I was telling the story today to that consumer. She tried to get me to go to DNA. She was like, "Here, take this sheet, get it signed at meetings." And I tell her, I'm like, "Ma'am, if you make me go to a room full of drug addicts talking about drugs, especially if there's females in the room, I'm going to get high and get laid." So, like, she exempted me from having my sheet signed. She's made me go see a therapist once a month instead. And this is so funny now that I fought NA so hard. And I am, right now, I am the region treasurer. I am my area chair. I'm my home group secretary. Like, I do NA. And I fought that shit for so long. I like to tell the story, like, I probably shouldn't say like because it's a horrible story. But my first NA experience was at Pruneytown, the prison. And I was in an honor dorm, so I could go to whichever meeting I wanted. They had different meetings for different dorms. And I was smuggling drugs between the two different dorms in an A meeting. You know, like all the fucked up shit I did to run from NA. And NA ends up being the thing that keeps me this way. And
yeah.
It'd be like that, man, all the time. Another thing I've noticed, and I talk about it on here all the time, so I want to get your little take on it, but what big part of my recovery is working out. It keeps me sane. It's like my meditation, makes me feel good. And I notice you've been getting in the gym, getting in after it. So, I just wanted to get your take on that. Something that's been helping you with your program, you think?
It definitely does. I'm at the gym every morning at 5 a.m. My alarm goes up at 3:50. I'm up by 4. I'm eating something because I don't want to lift empty. And I'm at the gym at 5. I love it. I'll be honest. I do more gym stuff than I do meetings anymore. Mm-hmm. And I love the therapy of it. 2 days a week, I work out with a good friend. Now he's an NA friend too, but 3 days a week I'm by myself. And we have other friends that want to come work out with us, and it really bothers me because, like, I like those by myself days. I like that day that I just have my headphones on and I'm compacting shit out of my head and just lifting something, you know?
I call it like an active meditation, because when I got my music going and I'm thinking about my whatever I'm doing, I'm not thinking about anything else, you know?
Yeah, I really love
that. That's cool, man. Well, one more thing I wanted to touch on before we get out of here is I met you actually at Healing Appalachia. So I was wondering, maybe tell everybody about that a little bit and then how you got that gig and stuff, because that's pretty sweet.
It's I lucked into this. it's actually really interesting. Yeah, first off, Healing Appalachia is a recovery benefit. I always say it's not a recovery event because there's going to be a lot of drugs and drunk people there. So don't go if you're not ready to be around that. It's a great time, and it'll happen next year. You can go next year. But don't go if you can't be around that yet. Early people, and I don't ever say what the time is. Like, some people are getting a week, some people aren't getting 3 years. But unless you can be around that, don't go, because it's going to be there. But anyway, it's Tyler Childers, and then the other bands change. It's great music. It's a great time. There is recovery camping, so you can camp in a place that will be drug-free and alcohol-free. They put on an extra little show over on that side every year, too. It's a great time. But my first one was 3 years ago, and I had volunteered to work a gate. I thought I was going to do. Like, they have different gates, you know, around to get people get in different areas, and I was just going to work a gate. And Joanna Vance is one of my best friends. She's great. And she was the volunteer coordinator. She took me with her, and she's like, I'm going to make you my assistant, and we'll walk through this. So we're walking through it. I'm half-assed paying attention because I'm not really going to have to do anything, you know? Well, the day of the event, they decide that she needed to be MC, and I'm going to be volunteer coordinator. And I'm like, I don't know what to do. You know, I'm like, what do I do with my hands? It's kind of all messy, you know? But I do. I bust my ass that first year. Not only was I mapping out everybody and making sure the gates were covered, I'd circle back around a second time with water because it was hot as hell, and I was making sure all the volunteers had water and food and stuff. And I busted my ass. And there's two Daves that run, or there's Charlie, Dave, and Dave. Charlie, I don't really know. He's like the big one. Don't really know him. But Dave and Dave have taken a liking to me because of that day, and now they let me go every year. They give me and my daughter backstage passes. My daughter totally fangirled Tyler last year because we got within like 4 feet of him. And I'm proud of her. She didn't squeal or nothing, but she was kind of tugging at me going, Dad, look, you know?
I got to meet him. He signed my t-shirt. It's pretty rad.
Hell yeah. The first year she got to put her head on the stage like this and watch him play. And that gave me Father of the Year vibes right there, you know?
Oh, yeah.
And it's really funny because that was my type of music. Like, I grew up listening to metal. You know, like, my first 20 concerts were Ozzy and Danzig and Godsmack and stuff. This was not my type of music. The first year I went, I never heard of Tyler Childers. I didn't know who he was. So I was just going to go do this recovery thing with Joanna, you know?
Yeah.
But since then, that's my playlist now. Arlo is my favorite. I'm just going to give Arlo McKinney a shout out. Arlo, and I have met a couple times, and I just saw him at Whiz Bangers, and he was awesome. And it's a good time.
Yeah, it's a really, really cool event because they do like sell alcohol there, like you said, but all the volunteers are most or all are in recovery. And is that right?
Yeah. I was gonna say, I'm sure there's somebody that's a cousin or brother or whatever, but everybody else is in recovery.
Yeah. And a lot of them are like currently in a facility that get to come, and like he said, you know, you get like a lot of backstage access, and you're around like the musicians, and you're put in a position of like helping or authority, and then you also get to see a concert for free, and it's just such a cool thing. It's one of those moments, I'm sure, for a lot of people of like, oh, wow, recovery can be fun. And look at this door. It's open for me. And look what I get to do. And there's a lot of booths there that sell art and stuff. And then a lot of the rehabs and stuff have rehabs and treatment facilities and different hospitals and stuff have booths. So you walk through and talk to everybody. And it's just a really good time, man. And so, yeah, if anybody is around Southern West Virginia around September, I recommend you get out there, and I'll definitely be seeing you out there because I went 2 years ago and haven't missed it since.
It's the third weekend of September. It'll be Thursday, Friday, and Saturday for the main people. There will be the Wednesday concert for the volunteers. And the benefit part is all the houses that help get checks. Like, whatever the money they is, they split it up and they give tens of thousands of dollars to all these houses.
See, what do you mean houses?
Like Recovery Point, Jacob Ladder, Seed Sower. I'm trying to think of some more. There's more. I'm just with you. My brain's not working.
Yeah, dude, I gotta say, dude, that's so rad that that even exists. Like, you know, I don't think anything like that exists out here at all in California. I've never heard of anything like that. And there should be more things like that, right? Like, especially with what we got going on out here. Like, you know what I mean? Like, it's just homeless people and people using it in the streets 24/7 out here in California. I think we could use more support for, you know, the recovery houses out here. So hats off to the people at Healing Appalachia, and especially you, my man, down there. What pretty soon you're going to be running the show. Yeah, you're going to be up there on the stage singing with Tyler Childers at this rate.
I got on the stage twice last year.
He's already doing it.
With Charlie, Charlie Godwin, Goodwin. I got on there and sang Country Roads. It was great. And then right before Government Mule came on, the person that was, because they do little stories in between the bands, and the person that was supposed to speak didn't show. I knew the girl that year too that was the MC. It was Autumn, M from Charleston, and she yells at me. She's like, "Brian, get up here and give me 5 minutes." So I went up there and gave 5 minutes in front of 12,000 people. It was crazy. Man.
That's the best recovery, man. That's so sick.
Absolutely. It's funny you mentioned Country Roads. It just reminded me, when we were in Greece, everyone would ask where we're from, and I'd say West Virginia, and about 75% of the people I said West Virginia to, they'd be like, "Oh, Country Roads."
Ah, John Denver.
Yeah, it's great. All right, man, before we get out of here, we have two questions that we always ask, and the first one is, what would you tell someone who's struggling right now?
There's another way, and I'm going to cry on you. If I can do it, anybody can. I sat in my mother's basement and was determined I was going to die with a needle in my arm. I just didn't know when. I'd given up. And then again, I didn't even do nothing. I got arrested. Like, it's not like I had some big epiphany moment that was there. It happened. And now you just put in some work. I do always tell people, like, recovery's not easy. If it was easy, we wouldn't have a drug problem. You know, you got to put in some work. But it's definitely worth it.
All right. And then the last one, and I think I might have a kind of a clue as to where you're going to go here, but maybe you'll throw a curveball. What's your favorite part of recovery, my man?
Ooh, that's tough. I know, you know, I'm going to say my kids. You're right. You know, that's the one you're going to think I'm going to do. I love the time with them. I love the relationships I have. Me and my son watch football all fall and racing all summer. My 15-year-old daughter is my best friend. My 21-year-old daughter now, which makes me feel old as fuck. But I actually have a relationship with, which is, you know, something I never thought of. But there's also just building a life. Like, I'm getting ready to get my master's degree. I'm going to be a therapist next year. You know, like, I mean, imagine walking into one of these places and my big ass with this giant beard, bald head, and tattoos all over me is your fucking therapist, you know?
Yeah.
I was like, somebody's going to walk out. Somebody's going to turn around and walk right back out. Like, no, I don't want to do that shit. it's the gift of recovery. It's a way to give it back. And one of the reasons I did that was you hear people always say that they'd rather do it from somebody that lived it than somebody that learned about it. I'm like, you know what? I'm going to do both.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to be the guy that lived it and studied it. So.
Fucking right, dude. Yeah, and I I will die on this hill, and I will fight anybody that I hear people, "Oh, people don't change," or addicts are piece of shit or something. I'm like, dude, you have no idea how many of my friends are lawyers, doctors, therapists that have been Narcan, have been to prison, have died multiple times, and they're out here fucking helping people. So I don't want to hear any slander about addicts or bad people, because I know a lot of fucking people who were the bottom of the bottom that are out here helping people. You know, one of my favorite ones is, we're not bad people trying to get good. We're good people trying to get better.
Yep.
Yeah.
That's a good one.
And warms my heart, brother. Proud of you. I'm happy for you.
Yeah, dude. And I'll tell you what, dude, they're not going to turn around and walk out. If I was walking into your treatment facility and saw that you were my counselor, I'd be like, fuck yeah, this guy's got to have some stories. I can relate to this fucking guy. You know what I mean? Cause you're big, you're tattooed, you're burly. You want the real ones, man. You want the real ones. So dude, this was fucking awesome, man. Thank you so much for coming on, and thanks for being so damn vulnerable, bro. You know, that's what we try to do here. So I'm super, honored that you felt comfortable enough to open up to us and have these hard conversations. So thank you so much, Brian. Maybe we'll have you back sometime, dude. Thank you.
Definitely. This was fun. We got 20 more topics we can talk about.
Yeah, it's true.
Yeah. And, you know, I was going to say real quick, one of my favorite parts of recovery is I've only met you maybe 4 times ever. But I feel like we're family, you know what I mean? And that's my thing is like, if you're in recovery trying to fix yourself and get better and you've been through the shit I've been through, then I love you, you know? And it's same thing. Like, I just think it's so cool. We're sitting here, we barely know each other, but we feel like family, you know what I mean? So,
yep. Amen.
Definitely.
Thanks for coming on, dude. I appreciate you. I appreciate you coming on, and we will, we'll have to do this again sometime, man.
Anytime. Y'all take care.
All right. Take care, brother.
Thanks, brother.
Find a good fight. Wow, dude. Now I got Rudy in here. Rudy just walked in. Hey, Ash.
What's up, rude dude?
Rude boy in here. Get out of here. I got dogs right, opening doors.
Like our namesake.
That's true, dude. Let me be the first to say, what a fucking awesome episode, dude. I don't usually get, I'm not the teary-eyed one of the Rude Gang, but there was a few moments there where old Kreeran here was about to cry. So that was fantastic, dude. And what a cool guy, dude. What a warm soul. You can just see it when he sits there. He's got that big infectious fucking smile, bro.
Dude, I definitely have the warm and fuzzies going on right now, man. That's the kind of stuff that we aim for here. And I feel good. I wasn't expecting to tell that little story about Lyndon and Katie, but, it's been on my mind lately. And, you know, I just wanted to connect with him and make him obviously feel not alone. And it's something that I struggle with too, you know, and that was something he really wanted to talk about. And I think it's cool. And I think it's cool for people to hear that, you know, we come through and we do have hearts and we do, you know, think about the things that we've done and, you know, try to do it a little better moving forward. And yeah, man, that was awesome.
Yeah, man, I was kind of having a shitty day, and this just really kind of turned it around, a nice 180. That was a great conversation, and I'm glad you brought up the Lyndon stuff, man, because you know what? Like I said earlier, I didn't think about it, and then when I sat here and almost cried, I was like, fuck, dude, that would be really difficult. That would be really difficult, and I hope this is rather eye-opening, kind of what you just said, to people who know somebody in active addiction who maybe wasn't the best parent and is now trying to be a parent, just know that, you know, they're fighting an internal battle as well. You know, they're not just trying to turn their lives around and trying to get their kids, but also, you know, like Brian was doing and like Henry does, there's another internal battle, you know, like we don't just do these things to our children when we're in active addiction on purpose. You know, I mean, yeah, we're responsible for it, but it's not like, hey, I'm enjoying doing this and I'm doing this on purpose for the most part. Now, there are some sick, vindictive, fucking crazy, terrible people out there. But for the most part, I like to believe that the scenario is kind of like you and Brian. So,
yeah. And the other thing I was thinking when he was saying how his daughter moved in with an addict and it made her realize some of the coolest interactions we've had from this show is like, well, I don't want to say who it was, but there was two people in particular that really were like, you know, I never thought of it until I listened to you guys talk. And it's so cool to hear an addict's or an alcoholic's perspective because I'd never thought of it that way. And I was able to find some grace for my husband or my mom or whoever it was. And that's why we do this, you know, and that's why I think it was great having Brian on and what he shared, because maybe we have a child of an addict that heard this episode today and thought, damn, you know, maybe I can find a little compassion for my parent because maybe it wasn't that fucking easy and maybe there's more going on than I knew about or whatever else, you know?
Yeah. Kind of like Brittany's episode, right? Like Britt's episode.
Yeah. That's exactly. One I was thinking of.
Yeah, just like
she
that.
She was like, it actually wasn't until I started listening to you guys. I was like, ah!
Shut it down. Let's go home.
From the Rude Gang, baby. That's what it's all about.
Unfortunately, we were a little too late, but I mean, you know, it is what it is. But I think she's found some.
Hey,
some...
it's not too late for Brittany. I mean, she still true. Found compassion, whether her mom's around or not. That forgiveness is for us. You know what I mean?
You know what, man? Great point. Way to call me on my shit. And you know what? I think Austin will probably be happy that we had a little tiff right there. There you go, Austin. We both didn't agree on something. You fucking asshole. You guys agree all right, too much. Dude.
Well, this week, we're going to put it out right now. We're starting to put a bunch more content on Instagram. So go follow us on Instagram if you haven't. And if you enjoyed this, if you got any value or you thought it would help somebody, send it to a friend. And
hit the follow button.
What else, Cam? Hit the follow, leave a review, send it to a friend.
Yeah, yeah. And if you're one of Brian's friends, because Brian's probably going to share this with everybody like he should, you know, hey, welcome. Welcome to the Rude Gang. Hit the follow button. Stick around. We have more conversations like this. We like to keep you lighthearted. We like to have a good time. And we like to show the lighter side of recovery. So if you're new, welcome very much.
Sometimes we cry.
Yeah, sometimes we cry. And sometimes we say crazy shit. Well, I don't think I have anything else, man. So it was great seeing you. What a great episode, man. So I will finish it like I always do. I love you very much, Hen. Thanks for opening up again. And one of these days, I got to cry on here.
Well, I almost got you. And I love you too, Cam. And remember, don't quit before the miracle happens. And be yourself. Fuck what they think.
Fuck California summers, bro. Later, dude. I'm fucking dying over here. You're hotter than Abby.